away. Hold these words, don't let them fall away. Hold these words, 'cause I don't wanna say you're the one that got away. So I'll keep holding on, hoping you'll do the same.
Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the Psychopath Edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, are you a psychopath? The problem with skepticism. Prohibition fails. Why can't you sleep? And is aspartame safe? Let's begin episode 360.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Let me start this week's show with an apology. As my loyal listeners likely know, I've not been around for the last couple of episodes, and today's show is, well, a web wisdom edition. You might ask why. Well, first, I work in retail, and the holidays are the busiest time of year by orders of magnitude. But more specifically, and you may have picked up on this already, my voice has suffered. To the point where I was unable really to talk for a week. And even now, it's still pretty rough, as you probably can hear. I was also afflicted with a few other seasonal infections. But rest assured, the holidays are over, my health is well on the way to returning as normal, and I am quite confident that 2017 will be the best year to date for Radio Freethinker. Next week's show will be part one of a two-part Best of 2016. Next week, we kick things off with discussing the top science stories of the year. So let's begin today's show with Ron Johnson, author of The Psychopath Test, in a talk entitled Strange Answers to the Psychopath Test. Let's listen and learn.
This story starts, I was at a friend's house and she had on her shelf a copy of the DSM manual, which is the Manual of Mental Disorders. It lists every known mental disorder. And it used to be back in the 50s a very slim pamphlet, and then it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and now it's 886 pages long, and it lists currently 374 mental disorders. So I was leafing through it wondering if I had any mental disorders, and it turns out I've got 12. I've got generalized anxiety disorder, which is a given. I've got nightmare disorder, which is categorized if you have recurrent dreams of being pursued or declared a failure. And all my dreams involve people chasing me down the street going, "You're a failure." I've got parent-child relational problems, which I blame my parents for. I'm kidding. And I've got malingering. And I think it's actually quite rare to have both malingering and generalized anxiety disorder, because malingering tends to make me feel very anxious. Anyway, I was looking through this book wondering if I was much crazier than I thought I was, or maybe it's not a good idea to diagnose yourself with a mental disorder if you're not a trained professional, or maybe the psychiatry profession has a kind of strange desire to label what's essentially normal human behavior as a mental disorder. I didn't know which of these things was true, but I thought it was kind of interesting, and I thought maybe I should meet a critic of psychiatry to get their view, which is how I ended up having lunch with the Scientologists. It was a man called Brian who runs a crack team of Scientologists who are determined to destroy psychiatry wherever it lies. They're called the CCHR. And I said to him, can you prove to me that psychiatry is a pseudoscience that can't be trusted? And he said, yes, we can prove it to you. And I said, how? And he said, we can introduce you to Tony. And I said, who's Tony? And he said, Tony's in Broadmoor. Now, Broadmoor is Broadmoor Hospital. It used to be known as the Broadmoor Asylum for the Criminally Insane. It's where they send the serial killers and the people who can't help themselves. And I said to Brian, well, what did Tony do? And he said, hardly anything. He beat someone up or something, and he decided to fake madness to get out of a prison sentence. But he faked it too well, and now he's stuck in Broadmoor, and nobody will believe he's sane. Do you want us to try and get you into Broadmoor to meet Tony? So I said, yes, please. So I got the train to Broadmoor. I began to yawn uncontrollably around Kempton Park, which apparently is what dogs also do when anxious. They yawn uncontrollably. And we got to Broadmoor, and I got taken through gate after gate after gate after gate into the wellness center, which is where you get to meet the patients. It looks like a giant Hampton Inn. It's all peach and pine and calming colors, and the only bold colors are the reds of the panic buttons. And the patients started drifting in, and they were quite overweight and wearing sweatpants and quite docile looking, and Brian, the Scientologist, whispered to me, they're medicated, which to the Scientologist is like the worst evil in the world, but I'm thinking it's probably a good idea. And then Brian said, here's Tony. And a man was walking in, and he wasn't overweight. He was in very good physical shape, and he wasn't wearing sweatpants. He was wearing a pinstripe suit, and he had his arm outstretched like someone out of The Apprentice. He looked like a man who wanted to wear an outfit that would convince me that he was very sane. And he sat down, and I said, so is it true that you faked your way in here? And he said, yep, absolutely. I beat someone up when I was 17, and I was in prison awaiting trial, and my cellmate said to me, you know what you have to do? Fake madness. Tell him you're mad, you'll get sent to some cushy hospital, nurses will bring you pizzas, you'll have your own PlayStation. So I said, well, how did you do it? He said, well, I asked to see the prison psychiatrist, and I'd just seen a film called Crash, in which people get sexual pleasure from crashing cars into walls. So I said to the psychiatrist, I get sexual pleasure from crashing cars into walls. And I said, what else? He said, oh, yeah, I told the psychiatrist that I wanted to watch women as they died because it would make me feel more normal. And I said, where'd you get that from? He said, oh, from a biography of Ted Bundy that they had in the prison library. Anyway, he faked madness too well, he said, and they didn't send him to some cushy hospital. They sent him to Broadmoor. And the minute he got there, he said, he took one look at the place, asked to see the psychiatrist, said, there's been a terrible misunderstanding. I'm not mentally ill. I said, how long have you been here for? He said, well, if I'd just done my time in prison for the original crime, I'd have got 5 years. I've been in Broadmoor for 12 years. Tony said that it's a lot harder to convince people you're sane than it is to convince them you're crazy. He said, I thought the best way to seem normal would be to talk to people normally about normal things like football and what's on TV. I subscribed to New Scientist, and recently they had an article about the US Army was training bumblebees to sniff out explosives. So I said to a nurse, did you know that the US Army's training bumblebees to sniff out explosives? When I read my medical notes, I saw they'd written, believes bees can sniff out explosives. He said, you know, they're always looking out for non-verbal clues to my mental state, but how do you sit in a sane way? How do you cross your legs in a sane way? It's just impossible. And when Tony said that to me, I thought to myself, am I sitting like a journalist? Am I crossing my legs like a journalist? He said, you know, I've got the Stockwell Strangler on one side of me, and I've got the Tiptoe Through the Tulips Rapist on the other side of me. So I tend to stay in my room a lot because I find them quite frightening. And they take that as a sign of madness. They say it proves that I'm aloof and grandiose. So only in Broadmoor would not wanting to hang out with serial killers be a sign of madness. Anyway, he seemed completely normal to me, but what did I know? And when I got home, I emailed his clinician, Anthony Maiden. I said, what's the story? And he said, yep, we accept that Tony faked madness to get out of a prison sentence because his hallucinations that had seemed quite cliché to begin with just vanished the minute he got to Broadmoor. However, we have assessed him and we've determined that what he is a psychopath. And in fact, faking madness is exactly the kind of cunning and manipulative act of a psychopath. It's on the checklist, cunning, manipulative. So faking your brain going wrong is evidence that your brain has gone wrong. And I spoke to other experts, and they said the pinstripe suit, classic psychopath, speaks to items 1 and 2 on the checklist, glibness, superficial charm, a grandiose sense of self-worth. And I said, well, I said, I wanted to hang out with the other patients. Classic psychopath, it speaks to grandiosity and also lack of empathy. So all the things that had seemed most normal about Tony was evidence, according to his clinician, that he was mad in this new way. He was a psychopath. And his clinician said to me, if you want to know more about psychopaths, you can go on a psychopath spotting course run by Robert Hare, who invented the psychopath checklist. So I did. I went on a psychopath spotting course, and I am now a certified, and I have to say extremely adept, psychopath spotter. So, here's the statistics. 1 in 100 regular people is a psychopath. So there's 1,500 people in this room. 15 of you are psychopaths. Although that figure rises to 4% of CEOs and business leaders, so I think there's a very good chance there's about 30 or 40 psychopaths in this room. It could be carnage by the end of the night. Hare said the reason why is because capitalism at its most ruthless rewards psychopathic behavior, the lack of empathy, the glibness, cunning, manipulative. In fact, capitalism, perhaps at its most remorseless, is a physical manifestation of psychopathy. It's like a form of psychopathy that's come down to affect us all. And Hare said to me, you know what, forget about some guy at Broadmoor who may or may not have faked madness. Who cares? That's not a big story. The big story, he said, is corporate psychopathy. You want to go and interview yourself some corporate psychopaths? So I gave it a try. I wrote to the Enron people. I said, can I come and interview you in prison to find out if you're psychopaths? They didn't reply. So I changed tack. I emailed Chainsaw Al Dunlap, the asset stripper from the 1990s. He would come into failing businesses and close down 30% of the workforce, just turn American towns into ghost towns. And I emailed him and I said, I believe you may have a very special brain anomaly that makes you special and interested in the predatory spirit and fearless. Can I come and interview you about your special brain anomaly? And he said, come on over. So I went to Al Dunlap's grand Florida mansion that was filled with sculptures of predatory animals. There were lions and tigers. He was taking me through the garden. There were falcons and eagles. He was saying to me over there, you've got sharks and more. He was saying this in a less effeminate way. You've got more sharks and you've got tigers. It was like Narnia. And then we went into his kitchen. Now, Al Dunlap would be brought in to save failing companies. He'd closed down 30% of the workforce, and he'd quite often fire people with a joke. Like, for instance, one famous story about him, somebody came up to him and said, I've just bought myself a new car. And he said, well, you may have a new car, but I'll tell you what you don't have, a job. So in his kitchen, he was standing there with his wife, Judy, and his bodyguard, Sean. And I said, you know how I said in my email that you might have a special brain anomaly that makes you special? And he said, yeah, it's an amazing theory. It's like Star Trek. You're going where no man has gone before. And I said, well, some psychologists might say that this makes you... And he said, what? And I said, a psychopath. And I said, I've got a list of psychopathic traits in my pocket. Can I go through them with you? And he looked intrigued, despite himself. And he said, OK, go on. And I said, OK, grandiose sense of self-worth, which I have to say would have been hard for him to deny because he was standing underneath a giant oil painting of himself. He said, well, you've got to believe in you. And I said, manipulative. He said, that's leadership. And I said, shallow affect, an inability to experience a range of emotions. And he said, who wants to be weighed down by some nonsense emotions? So he was going down the psychopath checklist, basically turning it into who moved my cheese. But I did notice something happening to me the day I was with Al Dunlap. Whenever he said anything to me that was kind of normal, like he said no to juvenile delinquency, he said he got accepted into West Point and you know, they don't let delinquents in West Point. He said no to many short-term marital relationships. He's only ever been married twice. Admittedly, his first wife cited in her divorce papers that he once threatened her with a knife and said he always wondered what human flesh tasted like. But people say stupid things to each other in bad marriages in the heat of an argument. And second marriage has lasted 41 years. So whenever he said anything to me that just seemed kind of non-psychopathic, I thought to myself, well, I'm not going to put that in my book. And then I realized that becoming a psychopath spotter had kind of turned me a little bit psychopathic. So I was desperate to shove him in a box marked psychopath. I was desperate to define him by his maddest edges. And I realized, oh my God, this is what I've been doing for 20 years. It's what all journalists do. We travel across the world with our notepads in our hands and we wait for the gems. And the gems are always the outermost aspects of our interviewee's personality. And we stitch them together like medieval monks and we leave the normal stuff on the floor. And you know, this is a country that overdiagnoses certain mental disorders hugely. Childhood bipolar, children as young as 4 are being labeled bipolar because they have temper tantrums, which scores them high on the bipolar checklist. When I got back to London, Tony phoned me. He said, why haven't you been returning my calls? I said, well, they said that you're a psychopath. And he said, I'm not a psychopath. He said, you know what? One of the items on the checklist is lack of remorse. But another item on the checklist is cunning manipulative. So when you say you feel remorse for your crime, they say, typical of the psychopath, to cunningly say he feels remorse when he doesn't. It's like witchcraft. They turn everything upside down. He said, I've got a tribunal coming up. Will you come to it? So I said, okay. So I went to his tribunal. And after 14 years in Broadmoor, they let him go. They decided that he shouldn't be held indefinitely because he scores high on a checklist that might mean that he would have a greater than average chance of recidivism. So they let him go. And outside in the corridor, he said to me, you know what, John? everyone's a bit psychopathic. He said, you are, I am. Well, obviously I am. I said, what are you going to do now? He said, I'm going to go to Belgium because there's a woman there that I fancy, but she's married, so I'm going to have to get a split up from her husband. Anyway, that was 2 years ago, and that's where my book ended. And for the last 20 months, everything was fine. Nothing bad happened. He was living with a girl outside London. He was, according to Brian the Scientologist, making up for lost time, which I know sounds ominous, but isn't necessarily ominous. Unfortunately, after 20 months, he did go back to jail for a month. He got into a fracas in a bar, he called it. Ended up going to jail for a month, which I know is bad, but at least a month implies that it's whatever the fracas was, wasn't too bad. And then he phoned me. And you know what? I think it's right that Tony is out, because you shouldn't define people by their maddest edges. And what Tony is he's a semi-psychopath. He's a grey area in a world that doesn't like grey areas. But the grey areas are where you find the complexity, and it's where you find the humanity, and it's where you find the truth. And Tony said to me, John, can I buy you a drink in a bar? I just want to thank you for everything you've done for me. And I didn't go. What would you have done? Thank you.
And we'll return after this break.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM CITR Vancouver, the show that is definitely not hosted by a sociopath. Although, that's what a sociopath would say. So maybe, and we're back. Let's follow that talk up with a clip from philosopher Jennifer Nagel about the problem of skepticism. The philosophical kind, that is. Let's listen and learn.
My name is Jennifer Nagel. I teach philosophy at the University of Toronto. And today, I want to talk to you about the problem of skepticism. What do you know for sure? Consider the fact that you are watching a video on your computer right now. Is this something you know? Before you say yes, consider the following question. Do you think it is possible for someone to dream that they're watching a video online when in fact they're asleep in bed with their computer turned off? Can you prove that you are now awake and not dreaming? If not, do you know that you are watching a real video as opposed to dreaming one up? If you start feeling inclined to doubt that you have knowledge, you're feeling the attraction of skepticism. Our word skepticism comes from ancient Greece, the home of not one but two great skeptical traditions, academic skepticism and Pyrrhonian skepticism. Academic skeptics argued that sensory impressions, which are often taken to be the foundation of knowledge about the world, don't actually enable you to know anything. Do you have the impression that the voice you are hearing now is the voice of the same person who narrated the first video in this series? I might have an identical twin. You might be misremembering, dreaming, or in some other way making a mistake. Because impressions can be misleading, you can't know that the same person is narrating both videos. The academics used arguments like that one to support their general conclusion that knowledge of the world is impossible for humans. Pyrrhonian skeptics went one step further. Their mission was just to keep on inquiring and doubting everything without reaching any conclusions at all. Where the academic skeptics argued that knowledge was impossible, the Pyrrhonian skeptics worked to suspend judgment even on that point, keeping all questions open. Some skeptical arguments have been known since antiquity and used in both Eastern and Western philosophy, most famously, the dreaming argument. If what you are now experiencing is just a dream, then it's not clear that you know anything about your immediate environment or even about yourself. The ancient Chinese philosopher, Zhuangzi, reported having dreamed that he was a butterfly and worried later that he did not know whether he was then a man dreaming he was a butterfly or whether he might now be a butterfly dreaming he was a man. You might think that there are some facts you could know whether or not you are dreaming. The 17th century philosopher René Descartes suggested that even if you are dreaming, you should still be able to know that a square has four sides or that 2 + 3 = 5. But Descartes found a way to raise skepticism about those facts, too. He noted that it feels natural to us to make those simple mathematical judgments, but pointed out that we could ask whether what feels natural to us really has to be true. Where does our nature come from, anyway? Descartes also developed a powerful skeptical scenario designed to make you doubt absolutely everything, including your grasp of abstract facts. Imagine that there is an evil genius of utmost power and cunning devoted to deceiving you. The evil genius controls all your sensory impressions and all your instincts about math and geometry and so on, making false things seem true to you. The challenge of skepticism, Descartes argues, is the challenge of proving that you are not right now in the hands of such a demon. In the next video, we'll look at Descartes' own way of answering that challenge. Meanwhile, various other powerful skeptical arguments have emerged since Descartes' time. The 18th century philosopher David Hume had some especially good ones, covered in detail in two separate Wi-Fi videos. Moving to the present day, we have a new version of Descartes' evil genius argument. Imagine a brain kept alive in a vat and connected to a supercomputer that delivers sensory signals that simulate the experience of a coherent reality. The computer also picks up the brain's outgoing motor signals and adjusts its inputs accordingly. When the brain sends out motor signals to raise a hand and touch something, the computer delivers coordinated visual and tactile input of seeing the hand and feeling what it touches. If the computer program is good enough, and let's assume that it is, the brain in a vat experiences a perfectly realistic virtual world. He could have experiences of going to the beach on a sunny day, meeting friends, being stuck in traffic, or being home alone, watching videos about philosophical topics. Is there anything you could point to in your present experience to prove that you aren't a brain in a vat? It won't help to pinch yourself. The local feeling of pain is just the kind of sensory signal that the supercomputer can easily supply the invatted brain. Typical skeptics don't try to prove that you actually are a brain in a vat. They will argue instead that it's bad enough that you just might be and you can't tell the difference. Even if you are in an ordinary physical world, watching a video and actually looking at your hand in front of you, we call that the good case. It's a problem that your experience feels just like the experience of the brain in the vat. He doesn't know that his hand is in front of him. He's just a brain. He doesn't even have hands. We call this the bad case. So even if you are in the good case and your experience really is coming from looking at your hand, you're just lucky that you're not in the bad case. You can't prove that you aren't, and your inability to rule out the bad case means that you don't actually know that your hand is really there in front of you. The dreaming argument, the evil genius, and the brain in a vat scenario are known as global skeptical scenarios. They raise doubts about virtually everything you would ordinarily take yourself to know. But skepticism doesn't have to be global. you can raise skeptical worries about some particular range of knowledge. For example, you can worry about your knowledge of the past. What if the whole universe just came into being 5 minutes ago, complete with fossils, antique-looking furniture, and your own apparent memory traces? If it did, it would look just the way it does now. But many of your beliefs, like your beliefs about what you did last summer, for example, would be false. In a more restricted local skepticism, we can raise skeptical worries about knowledge of single facts just by thinking of some possible way in which things might fail to be as they appear. Consider Alice, who's walking down the street and wondering what time it is. She glances up at the clock and sees that the hands show 4:30. Suppose that's right, and the clock is working fine. Ordinarily, we'd say, now Alice knows that it's 4:30. But if we highlight something that could have gone wrong, sometimes clocks are broken, and Alice didn't look long enough to be sure that the hands were moving, then it gets harder to see Alice as really knowing the time. If her quick glance isn't enough to tell the difference between a working clock and a broken one, then how does Alice really know what time it is? Just thinking about the possibility of error can make it seem like knowledge is really hard to attain. Do we always have to double-check that the clock is working in order to know the time? It's surprisingly easy to generate doubts about human knowledge, even knowledge of the kinds of things we'd ordinarily consider easily known, like whether there's a hand in front of your face right now. Skepticism, whether it's global or local, is an ancient and difficult problem.
Okay, let's shift gears a little here. And here's a clip from Knowledge Hub on the history of Prohibition and why it's failed. Let's listen and learn.
We all know the story. In the 1920s, those half-witted crazies from the rural parts decided that alcohol was the product of Satan's temptation to man. Mobsters popped up, people died, and everyone decided that it was a bad idea. Right? Well, not entirely. Prohibition is one of those moments in American history that is often pointed to as one of the great missteps in the nation's timeline, amongst other things. But it wasn't as clear-cut as it initially seems. So with that, we'll be taking a look at American prohibition of alcohol. Alcohol itself has been a part of culture for a very, very long time. While I don't intend to delve into the history of alcohol today, I do feel it's important to know why people decided that it was worth banning in the first place. First, let's start off in 1791 in the relatively new United States. The Revolutionary War had left a noticeable debt in the nation's financials. To ease this strain, a tax was proposed on the sale of alcohol produced within the nation. The idea to tax alcohol wasn't at random. It was considered luxury to an extent, and therefore the assumption was that the response would be relatively calm. At the same time, those who believed alcohol caused great pain in society through abuse, addiction, and drunkenness favored the tax to discourage its use. The response to this wasn't quite as calm as originally planned, and thus rebellion, death, and military response formed the core of the Whiskey Rebellion. Again, a story for another day. Alcohol was divisive to many. To some, it was a necessary part of life, an extension of the freedom Americans fought to gain. To others, it corrupted good men into shells of their former selves. Throughout the years, resistance to alcohol consumption grew. The resistance formed the core of temperance movements that popped up all over the world during the 18th through 20th centuries. As the 1800s went on, resistance to alcohol transformed from stopping alcoholism to stopping consumption of alcohol in general. Religion was quite core to the movement, with the drink being seen as immoral, as well as various women's rights movements, as drunk men could return home from bars to commit violence against family members. At the same time, poor water in the nation made alcohol quite the go-to drink for not catching various diseases. Prohibitionists, also known as dries, attempted to fix this by creating fountains of which people could get clean water for free. While these private ventures would not pop up everywhere due to cost, it was a movement in its own right, and some still stand today. Maine law seems to be a big catalyst in the advent of the prohibition movement. For the first time, state law dictated the sale of all alcohol, except for medicine. not particularly popular with many, and eventually led to a violent riot. Regardless, it inspired other states to seek prohibition, even though this major riot caused the repeal of the law, only to again be legislated just 3 decades later. It would be in the 1890s when more serious movements against alcohol started. The most important of these would be the Anti-Saloon League, or ASL. ASL was promoted as a religion-based organization that existed solely to combat alcohol. The goal was to ban it outright, and the means of doing this were quite shady, to say the least. ASL truly mastered the art of influencing mass media. It would function as a group that screamed the loudest, that fought the dirtiest, and would refuse to stop its goals. It would gain political allies through thinly veiled corruption. Basically, ASL would confront a politician, and if they agreed to join the cause, they would almost have a guaranteed spot in office. If they refused, they would nearly guaranteed lose the election. ASL was a political powerhouse that got whatever it wanted. It gained a fervent following among many, from progressives to racists, from intellectuals to the common worker. By using the persuasion of religion and morality, it would grow astronomically. The leader of this league was Wayne Wheeler, quite an unassuming looking man. An Ohioan who grew up on a farm, he would grow deep resentment from a young age for alcohol. He was injured by a worker on the farm who was quite drunk and managed to stab him with his farm tools. This event transformed Wheeler, who would go on to join the ASL after college. Starting low in the ranks, he would quickly move up with his natural, undying hatred of alcohol. He realized to further the movement, he needed a lot of public approval, and fast. This began his policy of Wheelerism, which would use the media to make it seem as though the general public was all in on a specific issue. How would this be achieved? Some rather dark means, actually. This is where the corruption comes into play, as fear against the ASL rained down for politicians. Wheeler was, by many means, not a man to argue with. He was unwilling to change minds on his beliefs, and instead opted to resort to pushing for laws that would be obviously against the general public. He saw only one option. Now, it's not to say the movement was all based in less than moral messaging and corruption. Many citizens supported ASL simply because they believed alcohol was genuinely making the world a worse place. Some just had a distaste of Germans after the war, and German culture was quite fond of alcohol. Anyway, for many, the idea was that if alcohol was eliminated, crime associated around alcohol would be too. Oh boy, were they wrong. This leads us to December 18th, 1917. On this day, the 18th Amendment was passed, which banned the creation and sale of alcohol. This did not apply to drinking it, however, so a rather major loophole existed for many. It would also be quite a while before this would be ratified. In the meantime, the Wartime Prohibition Act of 1917 would be passed, banning all alcohol over 2.75%. While it was intended to ration grain for the war effort, this would not be its final purpose, as the war ended just a week earlier. By January 16, 1919, the 18th Amendment was ratified, and alcohol would be made illegal on January 17, 1920. The Volstead Act was introduced to set forth more standards on the 18th Amendment, such as the specific percentages of alcohol allowed in home beverages, usually limited to 0.5%, passed on October 28, 1919. The immediate response to this was actually what was intended. Less people drank, and it seemed like overall the goal of the temperance movement succeeded. But this would start the downfall of the prohibition movement. Literally, just as it was starting. Business-savvy crime leaders saw opportunity in the passing of the act. The demand for alcohol would rise, and only those willing to operate outside the law would be willing to supply it. Some began to gather and collect alcohol in huge numbers as to sell it once the law would pass. As this illegal sale of alcohol became more fruitful, violence began to grow. Gang leaders became wealthy men, and this wealth brought power, control of vast areas with their resources. They were quite well known, in fact. And this would lead many to question, why weren't they arrested? The reason? Well, they were too powerful. If somebody would attempt to call them out, arrest them, or inform police, they would be killed or bribed. Those who demanded prohibition for a safer world were quite disappointed, to say the least. Crime rose, and many died. It seemed fairly evident the movement was failing. Many people would drink alcohol in these days under the safety of a local speakeasy. This location, hidden from local authorities, would garner a culture of its own. Women were more accepted here than bars of days past, and the world of men-only bars seemed to disappear. Jazz was very popular, and would reach mainstream status fairly quickly. Many opted for a more personal route. Moonshine would be made from homes with sometimes dangerous results, and personal wine cubes could be sold as fruit drinks that would include instructions on how to ferment. The American government wasn't too happy with the home brewing that was occurring, and the action it would take still leaves many in disbelief. Manufacturers of ethyl alcohol, a key ingredient to many homebrewers, would be instructed to basically poison the ingredient to a point where people would be blinded or killed if they attempted to drink it. This happened, obviously, but it seems hard to pinpoint a number of how many were killed by this rather terrifying action. The ASL was supportive of this movement, with old Wheeler going so far as to suggest that this was what was needed to happen. Support plummeted for the ASL, and it soon seemed apparent that the Prohibition movement lost most of its support. As the Great Depression caused major financial issues for the nation, legalization of alcohol became quite less of a necessity for the United States. After all, crime lords made billions off untaxed alcohol. Now America needed some of that dough. In March of 1933, this would lead to the Cullen-Harrison Act of 1933, which would legalize alcohol below 3.2%, which effectively legalized bars again. While not truly back to the level of days before Prohibition, it was a start. With this came the 21st Amendment on December 5th, 1933, effectively repealing the 18th. Contrary to some belief, it didn't actually make alcohol legal, it just leaves that up to the state. It removes the status of alcohol being outright illegal to make and sell everywhere in the USA, and states have taken up this opportunity. In many places, it's illegal to sell alcohol in stores on Sundays, and in others, it is much more restrictive. Kansas would make it so alcohol could not be served in a public bar until 1987, and even further, Mississippi still kept the same laws of prohibition until 1966. The effects of prohibition seem a bit abstract today. Obviously, alcohol is sold, and the foundation of many businesses here in the States. Bars function as social hubs for men and women alike, a result of the speakeasy days. Jazz is mainstream. What I'm getting at is the results of prohibition have changed America.
We'll return after this break.
Attention grad students, share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on 101.9 FM Vancouver, the skeptical broadcast with a prohibition on gullibility and ignorance. And we're back, shifting it again with a clip from Thoughty 2, where we ask the question, what is sleep, and why sometimes it's so hard to find? Let's listen and learn.
Hey, 42 here. The room is dark, the duvet is wrapped warm around you. You finally put your damn phone down and you wonder, why am I not asleep yet? Sometimes, no matter how much you want to, you simply cannot find the off button. You've tried everything, counting sheep, breathing exercises, listening to whale songs. You've even tried counting whales and listening to sheep songs, but nothing is working. Why does this happen? If Mother Nature decided that we needed to spend a third of the day recharging, then why did she make it so bloody difficult to do it? We all know how frustrating it can be. So let's try to understand what's preventing you from dozing off and how you can help it along a little. First things first, what is the difference between being awake and being asleep? You close your eyes, you lie still, you breathe deeply, you can even try dribbling a little if you like, but something special has to happen for you to make the mysterious switch to the other side. There are five stages of sleep. In the first, you move from an alpha state, basically daydreaming, into a theta state, where your brain locks down your muscles and prepares to move into a deeper sleep. You could say that you are technically asleep in theta, but very likely. It's at this stage where the hypnic jerk can occur, that moment when you suddenly twitch awake as if you're falling. We think it's likely to be caused by your brain still being conscious when sleep paralysis sets in. It could have been an evolutionary benefit so that our old primate ancestors didn't fall out of the tree when they had a little nap on a branch. But still, given that, in the US alone, 1.8 million people every year visit the emergency room because they fell out of bed. Evolution has quite a long way to go. In stage 2, your brain sends out waves called sleep spindles that we think are used as a sort of thought jammer to keep you calm and stop you from thinking about the washing up or that spreadsheet or where you hid the bodies. Stage 3 is to transition from light sleep into deep sleep. And stage 4 is where you get a rush of delta waves and you are in your deepest sleep. Stage 4 lasts about 30 minutes and is the best time to draw on somebody's face. Finally, you get stage 5, where REM sleep occurs, and this is when your body repairs itself, jots down memories permanently, and makes you feel rested. But the big question for today is, what kicks off the whole process? What happens to lead you to the fetus state in stage 1, where it all begins? So, there are two main factors that control sleepiness. One is sleep pressure, something that increases the longer that you've been awake for, and is created by the release of adenosine. The levels of adenosine rise whilst you're awake, and then you break it down whilst you sleep. The next factor is the light. We may now have 24-hour supermarkets and Skype calls at 3 a.m, but we're not designed for this. We're supposed to get up at sunrise and sleep at sunset, just like the Teletubbies. This is done through melatonin, which is released when it's dark, helping you to feel sleepy. As the sun rises, your body releases cortisol, which gets you up and ready for another day in your repetitive and pointless existence. Okay, so that all sounds very well, but what happens to interrupt this complicated process? One day you're snoring like a pig in a blanket, and then bam, you're up at 4 a.m. watching YouTube for the 5th night in a row. And although this video is both entertaining and educational, you're welcome, by the way, you'd probably rather be dreaming of a chocolate dinosaur and riding a Tyrannosaurus Twix and not waking up feeling like you've been in a cage fight. Stress is probably the main cause of why can't I effing sleep, because stress just throws all your systems out of whack. Hormone levels go all over the place, heart rhythms change, it's a mess. So you need to manage this through tackling the cause of your stress. Not saying that's easy, but there's plenty of professional support out there. Sorry, I can't help you on that front. Then there's drugs, both illegal and legal. Caffeine, for example, works by attaching to the adenosine receptors and speeding up nerve cell activity, where adenosine would typically slow it down. So no tea before bedtime, unless it's one of those herbal monstrosities. If you want to call some salad in hot water tea, that's your prerogative. I'll be over here with my comforting beige brew. When insomnia strikes, some people turn to alcohol or marijuana, but neither is really a great option. Both can help you to get to the early sleep stages fairly quickly, but they reduce the amount of time in stage 5, REM sleep, so you won't wake up feeling refreshed, and your room will smell of Foster's and Domino's pizza. When it comes to melatonin, the biggest enemy is your phone screen. It's thought that the biggest obstacle to most people falling asleep quickly today is technology. The light from a smartphone or laptop screen is enough to trick your brain into thinking it's still daylight, so you won't produce the necessary melatonin. It can increase the time it takes you to fall asleep by over an hour. It's important to give yourself a good 30 minutes before bed with no screens. You should try that new app where people take all of the subtitles from famous movies and print them out on real sheets of paper, except more articulately written. There's a lot of misinformation out there about sleep, partly because there is so much we don't understand. So let's try to tackle a few of the more common myths. Firstly, the obvious one, counting sheep. It's thought that this whole concept is derived from actual shepherds. They would worry about their flocks going missing at night, so to make sure all was well, they would go out and count up the little land clouds. For you and I though, with our worries being decidedly non-ovine, counting sheep is completely useless. It actually stimulates the active parts of your brain. You're much better off picturing a relaxing scene like a beach or a waterfall. And sure, that can include sheep if you like. Just make sure nobody else is in attendance, please. Exercise is very important to keep you healthy, and a good active day will help you to nod off quicker. But if you're restless, doing some sit-ups is only going to make things worse, since it will increase the adrenaline and, more importantly, raise your core temperature. Heat equilibrium is important for sleep, and you should be aiming to keep your extremities warm with socks, etc., but your core cool, which is easy if you have a frosty heart. And finally, we're often told that you can train yourself to need less sleep. Well, you can't. You can learn to put up with it and maybe control your mood a bit better, but the fact is, we each have a typical sleep requirement which differs from person to person, often 7 to 8 hours. And with any less than that, we won't be running at our optimum. Concentration will drop significantly, your temper will be shorter, and you'll find Janice in Human Resources that extra bit annoying. Sure, she's irritating on a good day, but without a good sleep, she's like listening to Paris Hilton reading 50 Shades of Grey over a severely bad Skype connection. But no matter how much sleep you manage to get each night, the best way to wake up feeling refreshed is to avoid waking up during deep sleep. Doing so will make you feel groggy and sleepy for hours afterwards. Wake up during light sleep and you'll feel awake and refreshed. But it's not just down to luck. You can actually plan to wake up during light sleep every morning. It takes your brain 90 minutes to go through one full sleep cycle. So, try to always set your alarm in 90-minute intervals, giving you the best chance of waking up during a light sleep phase. So, you could set your alarm for 6 hours after you go to bed, or 7.5 hours, or 9 hours. All are divisible by 90 minutes. Just make sure you factor in the average of 14 minutes it takes for a person to fall asleep. So, I hope this has helped some of you insomniacs out there. Although, I'm not sure it was too smart of me to tell my entire audience to stop staring at screens. No staring after midnight then. Deal? And for those of you who do sleep like a baby, I hope you have someone to change you in the middle of the night, because you really should have grown out of that by now.
And lastly, we have a clip from Today I Found Out, which answers the question, is aspartame bad for you? Let's listen and learn.
Hello, I'm Simon Whistler. You're watching the Today I Found Out YouTube channel, and in the video today, we're looking at whether aspartame is bad for you. A quick online search of aspartame will provide you with numerous opinions about this artificial sweetener. Some claim it causes things like cancer, seizures, multiple sclerosis, lupus, memory problems, and even brain tumors. Just about every governmental organization in the world regulating food products have deemed it safe for human consumption, though. But, you know, just about every governing body in the world still gets the sodium raises blood pressure myth wrong, despite overwhelming scientific evidence to the contrary. So let's not take their word on the whole aspartame thing. In an attempt to provide some sanity to the controversy, let's take an in-depth look at this sweet supposed compound of death and see if we can't make sense of the madness. Aspartame was first developed by G.D. Searle & Co. in 1965. In 1974, it gained approval from the FDA as a food additive. The benefit of using aspartame over sugar is the result of how sweet it is. Sugar and aspartame both contain about 4 calories per gram. However, aspartame is about 180 times sweeter than sugar, thus you need much less to get the same perception of sweetness. This is the reason it works so well as a low-calorie sweetener. Aspartame is made of the two amino acids phenylalanine and aspartic acid, and the alcohol methanol. All of the health concerns regarding this sweet supplement are a result of what these three things can do to the body. The question then becomes, do the three parts of aspartame cause health problems? The quick answer is yes, at high enough levels they do, but please don't stop watching here. The quick answer isn't the whole answer in this case. So if high doses of aspartame are harmful, why are they allowed in our food? It turns out low doses aren't harmful, and we even need these amino acids to perform certain functions within the body. In fact, phenylalanine and aspartic acid are either produced by our bodies from many other foods, or are already found naturally in our diets. Methanol, more commonly known as wood alcohol, is definitely not needed by our bodies. If you're wondering why it's allowed in aspartame, that's because it's already found in many drinks like wine, whiskey, tea and beer. As you might have guessed from the fact that humans have been ingesting these for ages at low levels, it seems that methanol has no long-term consequences. That said, anything we take into our bodies in high enough doses can be harmful. Arguably, the most basic of human needs is water, and even water in high doses can kill you in what is being called water intoxication. In the end, almost everything we take in needs to fall within a certain range to be beneficial, or at least not overly harmful. Some things, even in minuscule doses, can be deadly. For many others, it takes large doses to have lasting negative effects. The phrase "everything in moderation" comes to mind here. Since we already have aspartame's three ingredients in many of the foods we eat, the question of aspartame's safety is, more appropriately, are the levels found in aspartame and the dose you may be ingesting high enough to cause unwanted health effects? To answer that, I'll go into a little more depth on the aforementioned three things that make up aspartame. Aspartic acid is one of the many amino acids that help make the numerous proteins that our bodies use. It helps the liver by aiding in the removal of ammonia and is involved in the production of antibodies created by the immune system. It can be found in many different types of foods like asparagus, avocados, sugar beets, sausages, and molasses. Too much aspartic acid can be seen in several disease processes like Lou Gehrig's disease, epilepsy, and certain strokes. Unfortunately for those fighting against aspartame, the levels seen in these conditions are several-fold higher than can be achieved by eating aspartame at recommended amounts. There has also never been a direct cause and effect shown between these diseases and increased aspartic acid intake. Methanol, in general, does result in some unwanted reactions within the body. Specifically, it's taken up by the cells of the body, and the production of formaldehyde and formic acid are the result. Formaldehyde at high levels will cause proteins to form abnormally. The result is proteins that no longer function. Formic acid at high levels will cause abnormal metabolic processes within cells, causing them to cease functioning. The result is death to that cell due to a lack of energy. This is because it disrupts the organelle responsible for the cell's metabolism, known as your mitochondria. Some cells within the body are extremely sensitive to formic acid, specifically the ones in the optic nerve. This is why blindness is associated with methanol poisoning. So does aspartame produce enough methanol to harm people? Well, probably not. There are numerous foods we eat every day that have the same or even higher amounts of methanol than aspartame. Beer and wine aside, foods like tomatoes and tomato juice and citrus fruits and their associated juices are great examples here. This brings us to the last ingredient of aspartame, phenylalanine. There is a rare disorder called phenylketonuria, affecting about 1 in 10,000 people. This ailment leaves your body with an inability to break down phenylalanine. Left untreated, toxic levels of phenylalanine build up. The results can be things like developmental disorders, cardiac rhythm problems, seizures, and severe learning disabilities. Fortunately, most babies born in the developed world are tested for this disorder, and treatment usually involves diet control. Diet control because there are many foods that contain higher levels of phenylalanine than aspartame, specifically the many different types of proteins we take in. Knowing this disorder exists, the FDA requires that aspartame products be labeled specifically for phenylketonuria patients. Like any food additive evaluated by the FDA, there is an extensive process that takes place before manufacturers are allowed to put it in our foods. When the FDA first approved aspartame as an additive, there were numerous controversies surrounding its approval. These controversies revolved around the studies the FDA looked at, advocating aspartame's safety. That said, since its initial distributing to the masses, there have been countless new studies performed looking at aspartame's safety. Numerous other reviews of the research have been conducted by several agencies, including the FDA and the European Food Safety Authority, EFSA. The most recent was conducted by the EFSA and issued on December 10, 2013. The review looked at almost all studies performed on aspartame, in animals and humans alike. Knowing there is such a large controversy surrounding the supplement, the EFSA's independent panel of experts issued an open public call for any data, comments, or concerns on aspartame. According to Alicia Mortensen, chair of of the EFSA's panel, this opinion represents one of the most comprehensive risk assessments of aspartame ever undertaken. The panel concluded that aspartame does not cause cancer at the levels consumed by humans, and it doesn't cause problems during pregnancy. Overall, there were no safety concerns at the current ADI, acceptable daily intake, of 40 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. For your reference, according to the American Cancer Society, ACS, there are on average about 180 milligrams of aspartame in a typical 12-ounce can of diet soda. So an adult weighing 165 pounds would need to drink about 16 cans of diet soda per day to exceed the recommended limits, which itself is set drastically below dangerous thresholds. Specifically, according to the ACS, the acceptable daily intake is set at about 100 times less than the smallest amount that might cause health concerns based on studies done in lab animals. Not that you'd really be able to drink that much in reality, but if you did manage to drink 1,600 cans of diet soda in one day, that's one every 54 seconds, you'd have much bigger problems to worry about than your aspartame intake. Even though the EFSA's extremely comprehensive review should have put this issue to rest, there are researchers who still think they didn't go far enough. Eric Millstone, a science and food policy expert at the University of Sussex in the UK, wrote an open letter to colleagues in response to the EFSA's review. In it, he states the panel